we communicate through bank overseas a few times a day, but through the system, we can also communicate, it's encrypted. In other words, it's not like an email which can be hacked or whatever, and therefore it's possible. So yes, the problem is, if something goes wrong with the technology itself, how do you handle it if you cannot communicate with it?
So, this is why blockchain is revolutionary technology. It's because there is no administrator, and yet the system is able, based on algorithmic principle, to run itself. Yes, you get organizations like the Ethereum Foundation, which creates code, then by consensus of its users gets tested and picked up. But there's no centralizing administrator. I mean, if the Ethereum Foundation tonight releases the updates to the system and everyone thinks that it's garbage, no one's going to install it and it won't get updated. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why blockchains fork, why you have Ethereum and Ethereum Classic, because there's differences in the community as to how that certain consensus algorithm must be adopted. But once it's been adopted, that's that. There is no more administrator. The system is self-administrated. So, and I think I've almost answered the question. I think, so to talk about a blockchain administrator is to essentially be thinking in a pre-blockchain kind of way. It makes no sense to me to suppose what that administrator would be like. It wouldn't be a blockchain if you had one.
Yes, okay. No,
we have a comment from over there.
I'm a blockchain, by the way, so I mean, I should make that a different
sort of. Okay. I think, sorry if I may interrupt, I think what we need to differentiate is between the different types of blockchains. So a public blockchain is by its very nature public, it's decentralized, it disintermediates everybody in terms of any form of regulatory authority, and that's what the intention was and that's why it was built. So you have the public blockchain. When you get into private blockchains, that's when you have somebody who's centralized, who's going to ultimately validate control, because you can identify who the nodes are and the system is permissioned by its very definition. And then, of course, you get the hybrid of the two. So I think what you're saying is absolutely valid. On a public blockchain, the intention is that it's completely decentralized. It's a trustless system that you don't need to worry about who the other parties are on the system, because it operates via an algorithm and people are solving, or the miners are solving, certainly with Bitcoin, they're solving for the hash and the 18 zeros at the beginning. So I think that's where we need to just draw the distinction between the various forms of blockchains. Does it help?
Right, so we have over there.
Morning, my name's Hart. I'm a chartered accountant. We're the sort of guys that come in after the battle and stab the wounded. Your analogy about the photograph of the dog and then having the thumbprint, okay, I want to discuss with you, or for you to explain to us, if that's the case, when somebody hacks the wallets, because this is our biggest concern, is the security of your coins or your tokens in whichever wallet you choose. How are they able to use my picture of my dog with my thumbprint on it if they hack it and steal it? That's the part we're missing. We're looking for a secure wallet. So if I issue a token that's got an underlying asset, for example, gold in the ground, and I issue the token, how do I know where do I find a secure wallet?
Okay, so the security of wallets is your own responsibility, and you can keep it. No, I don't mean it like that way. But who said it that... I think Alan mentioned, that there can be bugs or hacks inside the blockchain, which it can be hacked. And if the blockchain is hacked, it means that you chose convenience over security, because there's a scale. On the one side, you have super convenience. You keep your private keys online, and you can use your coin or your token or your piece of digital data, which backs the diamond. Anywhere in the world, and only from your phone, because everything is on the cloud or online. Or you can go super secure and you keep away from anything that is online ever. You don't store your keys on a computer that's ever online. You don't store it on a phone. You can print it out on a piece of paper and have that physically. Or even more secure, you remember it, but then you die and your diamond dies with you. But if you go that level of security, then it's obviously very inconvenient. And so it's everything in between. Now, to come back to the inherent security of the blockchain, let's say you go super secure and you write your keys down on a piece of paper. That's the keys, meaning that that's what your fingerprint. Your fingerprint is derived from that key, or the other way around. And then, so what's the chances of someone actually hacking that and figuring out what your keys are when you didn't give it to them? Well, with today's computer technology, if you take an ASIC miner, which is the most efficient computer of solving these blockchain algorithms that is commercially available, if you take one of those and you have to run through all of the possible private keys that there might be within a SHA-256, which is a Bitcoin hashing algorithm, then it'll take you 4.5 billion years in order to mine that private key. So it's practically, for all practical reasons, it's impossible. Okay, in future that might change, because a cryptographic algorithm usually has a shelf life of between 20 and 30 years, and then the computer technology catches up with that algorithm, and it's possible to
hack it. A couple of Bitcoin exchanges, I think. Or
yeah, okay, so exchanges is a
and these coins disappear.
Yes.
Okay. So what are they providing as a secure place to put my Bitcoins or my tokens?
So exchange, for example, is part of the endpoint. So it's not the blockchain itself. It's only where you exchange between fiat and... So there's a service provider, and it's centralized around that service provider. So it's a large attack surface, and it's quite easy to attack that. Not easy, but compared to the blockchain, it's extremely easy to attack that. So if you operate around an exchange, the good rule of thumb to take your whatever you bought there, your Bitcoin, your Ethereum, or your diamond certificate, and then take it offline and put it in your own wallet somewhere where you keep your own keys. If you have your own keys and it's not stored by that party that handed you the keys, you must make sure you can Google it, and there are techies out there that can tell you, yes, it's stored or not, because they analyze the code. And then you can, and then keep it there where you have your own keys. You don't allow, like let's say you buy Bitcoin from Luna, right? You don't have the private key. Luna has it.
Yeah.
Luna keeps it somewhere. They either keep it online, I hope they don't, or they print it out and keep it in a safe, which is much more secure, or somewhere on a hard drive. So for someone to steal your Bitcoin from Luna, they physically have to get all of those keys. So if it's in a safe, I think it's safer. If it's somewhere on a computer, then...
On the Takealot site, that was the example. I want to use a Bitcoin to buy a charger.
Yeah.
I've got to have my key available to me in order to transact.
Correct. You need to prove you're the owner of that.
So you need a secure channel to transfer, and you need a Visa or something to transfer that coin to Takealot in order to take delivery of your charger.
Well, you're going to do it from you're going to do it from your own wallet, and you're going to not do it through the Takealot system. So they're going to provide you with an address in which you deposit the Bitcoin, and you'll have a receipt or a proof that you've actually done it, because it's recorded on the blockchain itself, and you can go and develop like a report from the blockchain to show that you have actually transferred the Bitcoin from there. So it's all transparent, it's all open, and it doesn't touch the Takealot system itself. It all happens on the blockchain.
So what you're saying is we need to use a manual system to look after our keys, keep them in the safe, and then bring them online when we want to use them.
Correct. That's exactly correct. Yes.
Right. Well, that deals with that one. Who's next? Other questions? Yes.
When I was considering investing in Bitcoin, there's two things that kind of stopped me. And that was, one is you just touched on now, it's about security and hacking anything else in these exchanges that you hack. And you know that it's already in the chat on where they're right now as we speak. And the other one was almost what you just almost touched on, the whole and the principle of anonymity. And in that respect, it's kind of just occurs to me that, and I think it's already been happening with the likes of watch list groups, call it ISIS, whatever, you can then utilize this for their own nefarious needs, etc., and also actually transiently hack and then charge often paid in Bitcoin. And in my mind, I just think there's no way at all that governments such as the US, etc., and Western governments or whatever will eventually allow this to continue. I mean, China's also already intervened and said, listen, okay, blockchain technology is one thing, but with Bitcoin or different types of cryptocurrencies, they can ban it. Now, in my mind, it's just ultimately a security risk, because when you haven't got line of sight, and it just comes back into the whole anonymity sort of situation. So I can't tell. I can come in, I can just get value from this and then build my next little dirty bomb, whatever. And that's, to me, is the big issue.
Yes, I agree. And you know, it's very comparable to the internet of the 90s. You know, lots of countries, I was very young at that point, but wanted to ban the internet because it's just full of pornography and that's only a meeting place for terrorists. And we know today that the internet changed our lives forever. So, and I think Bitcoin is following more or less the same trajectory if we take into account what has happened in the last 10 years. And I think also that, you know, it allows for permissionless innovation. It allows for exponential innovation, just like the internet has allowed for exponential innovation. Now a 12-year-old can go and write the next Amazon online. No one prevents him. There's no, there's literally no barrier to doing that, to innovation. And the blockchain does the same thing. So, and on the other hand, we have the regulatory part. Now I'm walking on dangerous ground here, but I'm just going to give my opinion. We have the regulatory ground, which is human operated. You know, you cannot use AI to regulate, but you can use artificial intelligence to innovate. So there's these two fields that need to interact with each other. But on the innovation side, you have 6.5 billion people available to innovate without needing anyone's permission. And it is just racing at the speed of light. And you have the regulatory part, which needs to catch up and try to maintain the same speed in order to control it. So, and that's a problem, you know. As we move along, as time goes on, innovation will just become easier and easier and easier for people to do. And regulation has kind of a fixed pace at which it can developed. So that's just my own point of view.
Pat, yes.
At the International Chamber of Commerce level and the Commercial Crime Bureau, we recognise that cybercrime is one of the major crime threats to business. How does cybercrime, how would it impact on what we've been discussing this morning, blockchain, Bitcoin?
Yes, so so cybercrime, it's a very vast field, but I think, again, comparing Bitcoin to the internet, you know, if you put someone online who's never been online in his life, and you give him a piece of the internet today, you will fall into a million traps. I mean, you will click on every link that he's not supposed to click on, and it'll just be a mess. But all of us here in the room today, we're online every day of our lives. And you know, we just know how to spot it. We know which links to click on and which not to click on. It's obvious to us. And today you will see Bitcoin scams everywhere, and lots of people falling into the trap. It's scary to read those stats of people losing money, investing in all kinds of Ponzi schemes and stuff. And I think as time goes on, you know, there's just like the internet. There's no one that's protecting you from this. No one protecting you from clicking on a link that you think is from your bank and providing them with your password. But we just learned to adapt to it and to see those things and to know the difference between malware and a virus and something that is not a virus. And as we go along, I think it's going to take some time. But after a few years, hopefully all of the human, you know, the global population would be educated enough to notice the difference between those kind of things. In terms of hacking, I think we've covered that. It is impossible to hack the blockchain. Theoretically, it is, but that's a whole long conversation. But practically, you need the state's funding. That's the kind of resources that we're talking about. You need a whole country to dedicate their resources in order to break the blockchain itself.
Okay, can I just ask you, in international trading, for example, we're talking about electronic rules of lading, we're talking about electronic letters of credit, which presumably would be a central ingredient going into a block trade. The issue is that when the banks talk about you having the option to accept an electronic document and should be lines the same, they are walking away from any responsibility, which seems to be a major issue in some of the advanced technologies that we're being faced with. Are we finding ourselves having to be personally more liable if something goes wrong?
Definitely, definitely. So, and I think the drive to decentralization is all about that. It is giving the responsibility back to the person itself. That's what Satoshi Nakamoto wanted to create the Bitcoin. He thought of himself as some kind of Robin Hood, who came to save all the people from the state, and put the responsibility back into the person's hand. And that's where we're going, definitely. So,
yes.
I'm not as negative about the regulatory protection that's available for a number of reasons. Firstly, I think there's a possibility that if one can't determine the jurisdiction, one can certainly rely on arbitration and the model law. I'm sure that one can fit it in there. And in terms of the exchange of an asset, if it's recognized as an asset and you've transferred it to somebody, there's an unjustified enrichment. And then in terms of how are we going to know if we are doing the right thing or not? When you were little and you put your hand on a hot stove, you burn. And there's no prior learning for a lot of people when it comes to blockchains, and we will learn.
Well, I mean, just on arbitration, let me comment on that, because that's something that I do know more about. And the key thing with arbitration and the problem with it, the problem here is parties have to agree. There has to be an agreement. The essence of arbitration is consensual, and any kind of dispute resolution process like that, it has to be consensual. A lot of the debate here today has been, well, you know, where do you find the contract? Where do you find the contractual terms, let alone a proper dispute resolution clause about anything? It's fine if parties do agree, but if they don't agree, what happens then?
You click on the box that says terms of service.
Okay, other questions? Right, well, on that note then, let me just thank all four of our speakers for what I think has been a very interesting morning, and I hope that our audience have all enjoyed that as well, and perhaps learnt one or two things along the way. So thank you all very much for being here.